The Triathlon Show 265. Hey, what's up everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and on today's episode I interview Dr. Trent Stellingworth. Trent is the Director of Performance Solutions at the Canadian Sport Institute Pacific in Victoria, Canada, where his primary research focuses are in nutrition and the interaction of nutrition and physiology. And he also has a keen interest in environmental factors and how they impact physiology and endurance performance, things like heat and altitude training, and of course, nutrition and how that interacts with the environmental conditions. In this interview, we will discuss the current best practices from both applied and scientific perspectives when it comes to endurance and ultra-endurance sports, ultra-endurance being defined as events lasting 4 hours or longer. And I just wanted to say that Trent really is one of the heavy hitters in endurance sports nutrition, one of the most well-respected researchers in his field. So it was a great honor to have him on, and I really hope that you will find this episode very interesting. But before we get into the interview, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Hydration, that you can find on precisionhydration.com. Something that quite a few listeners have been asking about is which Precision Hydration products to get, because Precision Hydration produce electrolytes, as you know, but they have different ways of providing them. So they have sachets and tablets and blister-packed capsules. So I'll be very brief and instead direct you to the article on the Precision Hydration website. When you go to the shop and you click on a product, you will have a link that will take you actually directly to an article describing the difference between the sachets or drink mixes and the tablets and the capsules. But in brief, the capsules, the blister pack capsules are perfect for things like the running leg of a triathlon race, because you can carry them around and you don't need to be carrying a lot of fluid to be able to consume them. The tablets are great. They have very sort of convenient packaging. You can have a lot of them in your jersey pockets, for example. And they're also non-caloric, so they don't have any energy, any calories in them. But they do have sweetener, so they're not natural. And the drink mixes are all natural because they, instead of sweetener, just contain sugar. So they also contain energy, so you can use the electrolytes as part of your fueling strategy as well. So those are the main differences. And you can, as I said, find out more on the Precision Hydration website. Go to the shop, and under each of those particular products, there is a link where you can get to the article that describes those differences and the different applications for them in more detail. But this is all to say that depending on the application, there should be a perfect electrolyte product for you on precisionhydration.com. And you can get 15% off that order with the promo code DETTRIATHLONSHOW15. And thank you to Roka, that you can find on roka.com. Roka has some really cool news in the eyewear category, and that is that they can now add blue light blocking coating on any pair of eyeglasses or reading glasses. And this is US only for now, but that is some exceptionally useful news because, as you may know, the blue light emitted by lighting all around us can have an impact on how well we sleep, how easily we fall asleep, and things like that. So if you are more sensitive in particular, but for anybody really, it can make sense to block some of that blue light late in the evening, the couple of hours before you're going to bed, and to be able to add that to your eyeglasses is really a perfect, very easy way of doing that. And by the way, that won't turn your glasses blue. It will be an invisible layer that looks just like normal glasses, but blocks the specific wavelength of that blue light. So check that out. Also remember that Roka has tons of other cool features in their eyewear category, like the ability to take an online vision test to upgrade your prescription. And also they have home try-on options. Go to roka.com/TTS to get 20% off your order, and go to roka.com and check out all the products. So without any further ado, let's get into the interview with Dr. Trent Stellingworth. Welcome to That Triathlon Show, Trent. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on.
It's a pleasure to have you. Can you start by just introducing yourself to the audience and tell them more about what you do and what your background is and so on?
Sure, yeah, no problem. I'm Trent Stellingworth, and I live in Victoria, British Columbia, Canada, where I'm one of the performance directors at the Canadian Sport Institute Pacific, which is one of our Canadian and Paralympic training centers. I primarily work with endurance sport athletes, so the sport of athletics or track and field, as well as a little bit of work in the past and currently with rowing and with triathlon and with mountain bike. And then on the side, I've worked with ultra runners and a few bits and bobs over the years. So I'm also adjunct at the local university. So I have a few grad students and try to plug away on sports science, applied sports science research when I can.
And you have a pretty decent athletics background yourself. Can you tell us more about that?
Oh, yeah, I was a pretty good okay middle distance runner in high school. And then I went to Cornell University and pursued track and field there. Everything from the 800 to cross country. I was a pretty decent national level type of person. During my PhD, I got into coaching. And since then, I've been coached or worked as a physiologist or in the area of nutrition with lots of track and field athletes. So, for example, my wife is a multi-time Olympian in the 1500, and probably if there's any sport I'm most up to speed on, it's distance running.
All right. And in your work, so you mentioned their nutrition being a key part of what you do. Can you just tell us a bit more about the scope of your work? Is it a lot of applied nutrition? How much is just regular, like exercise science, more broadly speaking, than nutrition? And in terms of your research, same question.
Yeah, I would say that over the last 5 to 10 years, I've probably evolved more into applied physiology than just sports nutrition. But prior to that time, almost every piece of research that I was undertaking or doing was looking at that intersection between nutrition and exercise, nutrition and physiology. And so, I don't know, of all my papers, I would assume about 75% of them involve some level or some aspect of nutrition, whether it's carbohydrate metabolism or sports nutrition or questionnaires. More recently, I've been involved in a lot of REDS research, relative energy deficiency in sport. But then I also have some papers just in and around heat acclimation and altitude training, for example, as well. So my sweet spot is really trying to marry up where nutrition meets exercise and exercise training and the periodization of those aspects. And I think later we'll try to unpack that a little more.
Yeah, yes, we'll get to that. But first, can you describe how important you think nutrition is, both when it comes to the day-to-day nutrition, but also in race nutrition, in endurance performance? Is it something that has potentially significant influence or marginal influence or no? Or yeah, what is the degree of importance there?
I think my answer to that might sound almost contradictory, but just hang with me here. I think in many instances, the barrier to entry or the ability to apply nutrition, generally speaking, is really easy. The barrier to entry is really low. If people just generally eat 3 or 4 nutritious meals a day with lots of colors and a range of macronutrients, and they include a few snacks, especially around training, you're probably 90 to 95% there. And on top of that are then all the, you know, little specific interventions that sports sciences and sports nutrition has research has kind of have shown. But conversely, even though the barrier to entry is kind of really easy or not too complex, we could also run an experiment and say, oh, okay, let's just skip nutrition for a couple of days and see how you feel. And obviously, everyone knows that you would feel horrible and you would feel weak and you'd have, you know, it wouldn't work. Even if you said, let's just, you know, what if you got, say, 50% less sleep in a night? Well, that impact's probably quite big. But if you ate 50% less calories for a few days, I would argue that the impact would be a lot greater in terms of just how you felt and how training would go, and especially how competition would go. And I've seen instances where athletes have come into a competition and been a bit nervous and not eaten enough and bonked, completely bonked, because they were underfueled for that competition. And so my answer to that is the barrier to entry is actually really easy. It takes some lifestyle interventions. You got to learn your way around the kitchen a little bit. But if you don't master that, then the impacts can be quite large. And especially if you don't take in any nutrition whatsoever, or even the basic minimum. So I hope that frames it maybe in a slightly different way.
Yeah, it does. And another perspective on that same question is there a difference between, so you mentioned there, well, the barrier to entry is really low, like we don't need to do a lot to get 90% of the way there. Those last few percentages, how important are they for amateur athletes compared to elite athletes? Of course, elite athletes need to do everything in their power to get those last few hundreds of a second if you're talking about the middle distance race potentially. But can you talk about that maybe? Is there a difference between amateurs and elites in that matter?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think in a lot of instances with interventions and sports science interventions or training interventions, we think very differently about the elite or professional athletes versus amateur athletes. In nutrition, in sports nutrition, I actually don't so much. It's more about the skills and the experiences and the knowledge that the individual presents, regardless of their background in sport of being elite or amateur. And just like sports sorts out who's elite and amateur, I also think about elite and amateur people in nutrition. And so in many ways, I've seen world-class athletes who are very amateur when it comes to their nutrition, and we need to work on their knowledge. We need to work on their skills. We need to work on their desire and their dedication. In other words, are they, you know, ready, willing, and able to engage in sports nutrition? And conversely, I've seen amateur athletes who are training quite a lot who have their nutrition just absolutely dialed in. And so just like you would in sport, when it comes to training, you would want to measure like where's an athlete's gaps. A gap is a gift. A gap is an opportunity to improve. We should do the same, and we do the same with in and around nutrition skills and application of nutrition skills. And so it really depends where the individual is on the spectrum of their nutrition expertise, regardless, I believe, in terms of their level, in terms of sport outcomes or competition.
All right. Yeah. And then before going into more nitty-gritty details here, I want to maybe get some high-level advice. So do you have like top pieces of advice regarding nutrition for endurance athletes that you can sort of say right away that these are the main things that you should be doing? And it can be at the very sort of low barrier to entry level, or it can be like very more detailed things, but things that you consider key pieces of advice.
Yeah, no sweat. I think some of those aspects and key pieces of advice, one would be trying to include nutrition options every 4 to 6 hours throughout the day. A lot of athletes will skip or have a very small breakfast, and that can be a big red flag over time, as a few studies have now shown if you chronically do that, you can develop some symptoms of REDS, I said it earlier, relative energy deficiency in sport. Regularly having foods or snacks every 4 to 6 hours, trying to spread your nutrition evenly throughout the day. A lot of people back end their day, so they'll eat just an absolute gargantuan meal at the end of the day. And I'm on a few papers where, for example, in protein, if you can only assimilate so much protein over every 4 to 6 hours, about 20 grams. And if, even though you've, you know, eating 60 grams at the end of the day, and on paper, you've checked off your daily protein requirements, you've done it in a very inefficient way. So spreading calories throughout the day is number two. Number three would be focusing on nutrition and calories, probably 20 to 25% of your total nutrition and calories wrapped up in and around training, and especially in the few hours after training. So just an emphasis there, especially hard training sessions. And so those would be the big three things that I would tend to look at and look for. Regarding competition, a really big one is, especially in endurance sport as we're focused on today, is really practicing and working on your carbohydrate and fluid or hydration plan. Ideally first in workouts that are going to mimic the race demand. So those really long, hard workouts so that when race day comes around, you have a really well practiced and well dialed in plan. But at the same time, you know, when and where you can make pivots or changes because, you know, things happen, especially in ultra races where sometimes, you might miss an aid station or drop a bottle or whatever. So those would be my big four or five points to focus on.
Yeah, that's really good advice, all of them. So thank you for that. Now, one topic that I want to discuss that you have done quite a bit of work in is periodized nutrition, as you already mentioned. And yeah, again, the context here is endurance athletes specifically. So can you talk a bit more about that? Well, you can sort of freely talk about this and I can maybe interject where needed or come with follow-up questions, but talk a bit about the proposed benefits and mechanisms, the evidence and the applied sort of science and so on.
Yeah, so I think in some ways the concept of periodized nutrition has probably gone above and beyond what I think many of us thought it might. And we can break it down quite simply to a definition, something like this. The purposeful nutrition intervention timed around training and or recovery or daily requirements. And within that, we can think about microperiodization. So it's how you place nutrition in the day or around training or even after training. Mesoperiodization of nutrition interventions, that might be something that lasts, you know, a week to a month. Like maybe that's a creatine loading phase or something along those lines. And then macroperiodization are concepts of thinking about nutrition along with training long-term over months to years. So we might think about body composition optimization. We might think of a prolonged iron supplement as examples of macro periodization. In a paper, I think about 15 or 17 years ago, it was the IOC consensus statement, and I was honored to be the lead author for the middle distance paper. We first presented this concept where we moved and showed caloric changes, estimated caloric changes, and macronutrient changes for a middle distance athlete throughout the year, because a middle distance runner at certain times of the year might be running 150 kilometers a week, but in competition phase, when they're tapered and they're getting ready to compete, they might only run, you know, 60 or 80 kilometers a week, and the intensity is much higher. So obviously the caloric requirements, just with what I've stated, are very profound and very, very different. I think in many instances, periodized nutrition is just obvious and it already happens serendipitously or by chance. So for example, there's a lot of research and science around the periodized implementation of low glycogen and low carbohydrate availability training. But conversely, you know, when I worked more closely with our Olympic rowing program, they would have triple days. So they'd be on the water three times in a day. And the 70-year-old coach doesn't know anything about molecular signaling or AMP kinase or low carbohydrate availability training. But I don't need to take muscle biopsies to tell you that on the third hard training session on the water of the day at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, those folks have low muscle glycogen. And it kind of happens by chance in some instances and through trial and error of coaches. So it's a massive topic when you present it like that. And basically, it's just important for people to understand the demands of the training and the demands of the competition. So like what physically determines the performance, and then try to match up appropriate nutrition interventions for those gaps. So for example, you're not going to give creatine to a marathoner because the performance determinants of the marathon are much different than in sprinting. But you might consider creatine supplementation at certain times of the year in a sprinter. And so those are some simple examples and hopefully frames that really large area.
Yeah, and I think that a big one that that you mentioned there that has been researched a lot in recent years is the low glycogen paradigm and training sometimes with low glycogen stores and sometimes with high glycogen stores. And if we go a bit deeper into that specifically, I've talked with a lot of coaches in both triathlon and in cycling in particular that say that they either don't do it because they kind of know that they are anyway going to end up in low glycogen just based on the volume of training, as you mentioned there with the rowing example.
Yeah.
I have also talked with some coaches that mentioned that they are doing it, but they are quite careful with it, maybe doing it for a few weeks, once per week tends to be what they do in that case. And very few would do it more often than that. And in some of the research, it is taken to a bit more of an extreme, if you will. So if you approach this first from like the applied side of things, what do you do when you consult with athletes and coaches in your neck of the woods there?
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of moderating factors and contextual factors that we don't always raise up when regarding low carbohydrate availability or low glycogen training and the application of that. And some of those moderating factors are the fact or the idea that in non-weight dependent, low eccentric sports, so cycling, rowing, swimming, they normally and routinely do 20 to 30 hours of training a week. In weight dependent, eccentric type sport like running, even your top Kenyan marathoners will top out at maybe 12 hours of running a week. It is a completely different paradigm in terms of neuromuscular load and fatigue and glycogen utilization rates and in thinking about applying low carbohydrate availability in those two paradigms or in those two different groupings of sports, strut endurance versus power endurance. And so in many instances, if you're a cyclist and you know, as a coach, you want to bring the cyclist over the next couple of years to 25 and 30 hour weeks. If you still got training headroom to move into, you might focus on that first before starting to play around and manipulate carbohydrate availability. Conversely, if you're a marathoner and you physically can't run more steps because of increased injury risk, because it does pound on you, it's pretty hard to get over 250 or even 200 kilometers a week of running. How do we there mimic the demands of the last 10K of the marathon without having to send the athlete out for 30 kilometers of running first? Well, we can do that through sports nutrition. We can manipulate carbohydrate availability so that when they, you know, do a 1 hour run in the afternoon after hard intervals in the morning where they haven't recovered with carbohydrate intake, that 1 hour run or that 90 minute run in the afternoon feels an awful lot like the last 10K of a marathon because they're under low muscle glycogen conditions. And so I think that there's a lot of moderating factors we need to think about around the application of that, including the level of the athlete, the total training durations that the athletes typically do, whether or not they still have training headroom to move into, you know, they're young and developing still, what their overall nutrition expertise and skills are, because implementing some of this stuff at home with an athlete on their own is much different than the examples that, you know, Asker Eukendroop or James Morton show us in professional cycling, where, you know, they have a full-time paid chef along with an assistant registered dietitian, along with James and Asker to look over the whole program. Well, that's, you know, you can implement some of these complex things and an entire team there much more easily, you know, given that professional setup that the vast majority of athletes don't have, even elite endurance athletes. So those are the types of conversations I'll have with athletes and coaches when thinking about trying to implement aspects of this. And, you know, what is it feasible? Is it what are the logistics? But then we also look at all of this is, in many instances, people think it is always a reward, but there's also risk involved. You risk underfeeling the athlete. You risk the potential, if this is done too often and too long, to potentially downregulate the ability for carbohydrate oxidation, which is really important for high intensity intervals. And there's now a couple of papers emerging showing low carbohydrate availability increases bone markers for increased bone breakdown. So there could be a bone risk involved with this as well. Now, they're emerging papers, and we need to look more carefully at it, but there are a couple of examples now in the literature out of the Louise Burke's lab, the Australian Institute of Sport, and out of James Morton's lab in Liverpool. The first author is Hammond et al., showing this increase in bone breakdown markers in the blood with low carbohydrate availability training. So I think, as with everything in life, there's a sweet spot and there's a risk and reward, and it's always important to think about those moderating factors and the context of the environment that you're working in.
Would the new bone marker research be perhaps a bit of a contraindication for women to undertake this kind of protocol, since they might be more prone to lower bone density, and even young athletes that are still growing, still developing?
No, exactly. And those would be two other moderating factors. We could have a great brainstorm here and come up with a list of contextual or moderating factors that a practitioner needs to consider when applying an intervention. And someone with low bone mineral density, of which women are more at risk for that than males, would be a moderating factor. The level of the athlete, for sure. Now, those studies are just emerging, and I'm just highlighting them. They're literally published in the last year, but it is an interesting paradigm. And at least the unpublished data out of the Australian Institute of Sport shows that the bone markers of breakdown are worse in low carbohydrate availability than low energy availability, at least over 5 days. And so then your head starts to spin, like, okay, are all these low energy availability research papers, they almost all always result in low carbohydrate availability, because energy availability and carbohydrate availability tend to go hand in hand, up and down together. That's what you manipulate. And because you don't move protein much, so you're putting the carbs and fat up and down. You only have two levers there. And so, are some of the bone outcomes that we've seen in Red's papers and Triad papers, are they a result of the low energy availability or the low carbohydrate availability or both? And I think there's still a lot of question marks there that we need to unpack further.
Yeah. I'll mention at this point to the listeners that we had an episode, an interview with Margot Mountjoy, who I know you've worked a lot with, on, among other things, the IOC consensus statement on REDS. So I'll link to that episode in the show notes for listeners that want to go back and listen to that. But coming back to the benefits, the potential benefits of training with low glycogen availability, you mentioned there for marathoners being able to simulate the latter part of the race. So that's a kind of race-specific benefit. What are the other benefits? Are there mechanistic benefits, signaling and things? What is the level of evidence when it comes to actual performance?
Yeah, so there tends to be a philosophy in many endurance coaches that you get 75% of your adaptation in the last 25% of the workout, you know, give or take, something like that. And I think a lot of that syncs up with the idea that your glycogen stores and your glucose availability late in the workout are always the lowest as well. And I would say that there is, over the last 15 or 20 years, a very large piece of strong evidence to show that your signaling molecules in your skeletal muscle, signaling proteins, are upregulated when training with low glycogen contents. And so what that means is, obviously, there's responses within the muscle to endurance training. Those responses can also be amplified when that endurance training occurs with low muscle glycogen or low glucose availability, such as morning fasted training. and that the signaling cascade there tends to work through AMP kinase and PGC1 alpha, and then there's also the PPAR deltas from the fat side of things. It's a whole alphabet soup to say, on paper, it looks like you will induce more mitochondrial biogenesis, more fat and carbohydrate transporters, more capillarization. In other words, an endurance phenotype. We're creating an extra stress to further push that muscle into an adapted endurance phenotypic state. And I think that the data for the signaling is super strong. Where the data is not as strong is the studies that have then tried to incorporate performance outcomes. So you'll have usually a two-group design, and one group will do a bit of periodic low glycogen training, usually every other workout. The other group will do every workout with high carbohydrate availability, you know, and then they have biopsies and they'll measure performance pre and post, and both groups equally improve. And so the finding the definitive outcome of training has been challenging. However, you also have to interpret and look at each of these studies very carefully. And I'm going to go into a little bit of a rabbit hole to frame these studies. Most of these studies implement open, self-selected training. And that's how athletes train. If you have an interval session, the athletes are going to try to run or bike that interval session as hard as they can over the 5 reps. When you induce and undertake low glycogen training, the total work done tends to be lower because you can't hit as high a wattage or you can't run as fast. And so because it's self-selected training and because the low glycogen group tends to do less total work, even though that less total work might be amplified in the muscle, you might just end up almost in a net neutral space because the high carbohydrate group is able to just push more wattage or do more work. And in the end, both groups almost end up in the same situation at the end of the workout. Even though the signaling might be a little bit different, some of the mechanical forces and the stresses on the body in the high glycogen group might have enhanced training outcomes, you know, in a slightly different way. So it's important to think about the training that way, because it does somewhat change the interpretation of what you're doing and how you're implementing it.
Yeah, those are some key points. And this is just my coaching speculation and how I sometimes have implemented this. But I would never implement this in those high-intensity workouts. I would always encourage the athletes to get into the high-intensity workouts with good glycogen stores and having fueled appropriately beforehand. And when training low, that would be more like an endurance workout. It could potentially be more of a moderate intensity workout, but not something that is above threshold, so to say. And I don't know, that's just my sort of how I've done it. So now I'd like you to comment on what's right or wrong about that.
I 100% agree with you. And some of the early studies in this field had flipped the intervention around, where they used a long 100 or 150 minute ride to lower glycogen, and then they would feed a low carbohydrate diet for 4 or 5 hours, and then the athletes would come in to do intervals at high intensity intervals on low muscle glycogen. And I had a lot of discussions 10, 15 years ago. I was like, the coach in me is like, that's the opposite way of the way that I would think about implementing this paradigm. And I think that has shifted. There's a great open access paper out of James Morton's groups in Liverpool by Sam Impey called Fuel for the Work Required that goes over this entire field. So for the listener, if you're interested in this, check that great paper out. And in the back end of that paper, there's a practical session where they have the application of carbohydrate availability across a 4 or 5 day training program. And James has it highlighted as a traffic light: green, high carb; yellow, medium carb; red, low carb sessions. And you can see in there exactly the implementation of carbohydrate availability, like you've just said, is let's keep the high intensity intervals well fueled, maximize the neuromuscular overload, maximize the wattages as best as we can. And then off of those workouts, when you have a prolonged, you know, aerobic, you know, fat adaptation type of endurance session that's going to be many, many hours, it's there that you might manipulate the carbohydrate availability.
Mm. Coming back to the point of science not having shown yet any performance benefits or a constant high carbohydrate availability diet, could that be because if they have actually been doing more or less every other workout in a depleted state, that over the course of an entire training cycle, they end up doing significantly less work than the high carbohydrate group? And so maybe the amount of work in a low glycogen state is simply too much overall, irrespective of which sessions those are in.
Yeah, that's exactly one interpretation of the data. And to be clear, like, there are some studies that have shown performance benefits of low carbohydrate availability. My point is just that the consistency of that data is not there. It's a bit all over. So if we take the famous supernova sport nutrition studies that have been done on world-class race walkers with Louise Burke out of the Australian Institute of Sport, they've had a few group designs where it's 100% high carbohydrate availability, 100% low carbohydrate availability. In other words, a group on a keto diet, and then a group that periodizes it. So they move carbohydrate availability around. And the high carbohydrate availability and the periodized group both had improvements in performance equally, statistically equally, while the keto group actually went a bit slower and had no improvement in performance over a three-week training camp. So there's an example where the periodized approach was no better than the high carbohydrate availability approach. The other really challenging piece with studies in the literature is classically, you'll get recreationally trained males come in where they'll do, say, maybe six sessions a week of training, of which three of them have low carbohydrate availability. And they'll do a three-week training block and measure pre and post over 3 weeks. And so you're looking at a total of nine sessions of low carbohydrate availability, three per week, out of 18 total training sessions. Our Olympic rowers, if you add in weight room, they do 18 sessions a week. And so the stimulus that you get with just nine sessions over 3 weeks, and I'm not pooing on the data, it is really hard to do this stuff and control nutrition. And 3 weeks is already a gargantuan training study. It's just, you know, how much does that little slice of data in recreationally trained athletes really represent what elite athletes are doing in the field, week in, week out, year in, year out?
Yeah, no, that's a really, really excellent point. Bringing it to the amateurs, so you mentioned there when talking about runners that since they're limited by the impact of the sport, running being so different from cycling and swimming and other disciplines, that for them it might make a lot of sense to do this because they can't sort of lift the stimulus by increasing their training volume. And we might have the same in theory going on with amateur athletes that are limited by having a job and having a family and not being able to train as much as they could do just physically if they got paid for it and so on. So what is your take on amateurs implementing the periodized nutrition paradigm from in that context?
Yeah, so you know what we're getting at here is maximizing the training bang for the buck, and we're trying to. How can we get more per step or more per pedal revolution or swim stroke? And you're right. And there have been instances with more amateur recreational athletes who are still training at a pretty high level, but they're you know, full-time business people and they're time limited, where when working with them, we've checked and done a bit of an audit, like how is your general nutrition? Are you at risk for an eating disorder, disordered eating? Do you have it? We went through all the moderating factors we talked about earlier in the podcast, and generally it looked okay to try and implement something like this. And I have more in my old life. When I used to live in Switzerland, I used to work and consult with a few kind of more high-end Ironman businessmen and businesswomen, where we would implement some aspects of low carbohydrate availability training to just try and create a little more of a signal or stimulus per training session, because they just didn't have the time to get the hours in. So there is potential application there for sure, as long as they're able to execute things and stay healthy.
And when you worked with that kind of athlete, the Ironman working man or woman, how often would you implement that per week roughly? And would it be year round or would it be specific periods of the year?
Well, usually in those instances, if they would come to me and they had like a goal or a project, like I want to qualify for the time cutoff at Boston, or I want to qualify for Ironman Switzerland, I'd usually have a reality check conversation with them first and really lay down the type of commitment and the weeks required to satisfy that goal, given where they were and where they wanted to go. I would really highlight to them that they need to go home and talk to their partner and family about this goal and be really transparent and clear. I would then ask them to come to me and show to me clearly in their schedule and agenda where they can put the work in to make this goal occur. And unless those things happened up front, I would usually be pretty reticent or cautious to want to get involved in the project, because it's fine to verbalize these really big audacious goals, but if you just don't even have it set up in your lifestyle to go after it, then that's challenging. Or I would say, okay, let's just have a goal around getting consistent and fit, and then work from there. And maybe in a year from now, we talk about trying to qualify for Boston or Ironman. So that's first and foremost the reality check. Secondly, I would usually try to work with the person a little while just to get and better understand their ebbs and flows of training and how they're responding and how they're feeling. And then thirdly, there would be instances, perhaps maybe two, maximum three times a week, where we might implement some level of carbohydrate manipulation. Classically, the easiest one to do is morning fasted training. However, over the years, I think the stimulus you get out of that is a much less than low muscle glycogen training. And so, you know, they'll get up, they'll have some water, a cup of coffee, you know, and then go out for a 2-hour ride at first thing in the morning. As an example, the lower muscle glycogen training, especially in run training, tends to be physically results in much higher RPEs and is really challenging. So in those instances, we might save those for a Saturday or a Sunday when they have more time to recover afterwards, and they're not, you know, also putting in, if they're executives, perhaps a 10 hour plus work day. So again, there's all those moderating and contextual factors that you need to work through and figuring out if and when and how much you can implement this or at all with each person that you work with.
Yeah. Okay. That's good. And finally, for future directions of this field, what do you think is going on, and what new data are we expecting, waiting on? And also, what kind of work do you want to see done in the future? If you can just dream up your dream study.
So I think, you mentioned you had Margot Mountjoy on recently. I think there's a real scientific but also community onslaught, and I say that in a positive way, around relative energy deficiency in sport and the need and requirement for more female-specific data to understand that females are not just small males. And I know a lot of colleagues around the world have been starting to work more and more around relative energy deficiency in sport and what that is, and what's the diagnosis exactly, and what are more early indicators and markers. So I'll highlight that, and I think we're going to make significant progress in that space in the next 5 and 10 years. I'll also highlight that I think in many instances, overtraining syndrome is actually REDS. And a bunch of us are working on a review paper to unpack that simple statement, but it's incredibly complex. because the underpinning etiology of REDS is energy availability. And the equation of energy availability is simple. It's energy intake minus exercise energy expenditure divided by fat-free mass. So energy intake minus exercise energy expenditure. And the REDS and nutrition folks tend to focus a lot on energy intake. And of course, all the overtraining, overreaching, training overload research and data is on the exercise part of that energy availability equation. And I think that that energy availability equation nicely links up concepts of both REDS and overtraining. And so I think we're going to see a shift in the literature that better appreciates the fact that underfueling and energy intake are intimately linked to many, not all, many of the overtraining syndrome symptoms. And if you look at some of the literature around overtraining symptom markers, the crossover with the REDS markers is profound. It's like you could almost take a paper, flip out OTS, put in REDS, or vice versa, take out REDS and just put in OTS, and you could read the paper. It would work either way. Now, I'm not at all saying that poor energy intake or energy availability is the exclusive reason for overtraining. You could have good energy intake and a complete lack of sleep, which could be the primary driver of an overtraining issue. But I do think in many, many instances that is a huge confounding factor that is probably not as appreciated in the literature and out with coaches and sports medicine physicians as it should be. And so that's another area that I think we're going to see more and more information on in the next 5 or 10 years.
And specifically within the concept of periodized nutrition, is there anything there that you think we'll see or that you would want us to see coming out from the research?
Yes. Maybe in that piece, I'll mention that I think from an athlete perspective, we've come a long ways, but we still have a long ways to go to know how to best periodize an iron supplement. We didn't even touch on iron. Iron is massively important in endurance sport for blood health and hemoglobin health. And Pete Peeling's group out of Australia has done, and I've been involved in a few of those papers and reviews. We've collaborated a bit with him, but mainly his group has done a great job highlighting how you might start to think about periodizing your iron supplement within the day, within training, within hard training blocks of the year, within light training blocks of the year. But there are still a lot of questions that remain there around the periodization of iron supplements.
Well, that is really interesting. Can you give a brief overview of what we do know today about that?
Sure, I can try to do it briefly. I think a lot of what we know hinges on the fact that about 20 years ago, the counter-regulatory protein-based hormone hepcidin was isolated and identified. And hepcidin is released during situations of inflammation to slow and or block iron absorption. So when hepcidin is high in the blood and circulating, the ability to maximize iron absorption, the bioavailability of iron absorption, is decreased. And originally, hepcidin was first identified in disease state and inflammatory states, mainly because bacteria need iron to proliferate. And therefore, it was probably an evolution counter mechanism to say, oh, if there's, you're in a disease state and there's bacteria, we should limit iron absorption so that that limits bacteria proliferation. But it's also increased with hard exercise. So acutely, hepcidin is increased over 4 to 6 hours after a hard training session because, again, training is an inflammatory response. Hepcidin, we know at altitude, actually initially increases and then starts to decrease. Hepcidin is acutely increased when you actually give an iron supplement. So splitting your iron supplement dose during the day results in lower bioavailability than just taking a single dose because of the negative feedback loop of hepcidin. We know hepcidin is higher in situations of poor energy availability. So there's some data on the anorexic research showing that hepcidin is higher, and perhaps that's part of a reason why a lot of athletes with reds also have low iron or have a very hard time getting their iron ferritin statuses in their bloods up to an adequate level, even with supplementation. And then finally, we know hepcidin is higher late in the day. So there's a circadian rhythm to it rather than early in the day. So that impacts all the areas and times and how you might think about when and where you place your iron supplement. And I haven't even talked about the idea that calcium slows bioavailability of iron. Vitamin C increases bioavailability of iron. Tannins slow bioavailability of iron. So tannins are in tea and coffee. And so there's just all these confounding factors that play into how and when and where you might choose to put an iron supplement. And so, long story short, we try to use a single dose iron supplement, not multiple doses throughout the day. And we have a paper at Altitude showing a single dose resulted in more hemoglobin mass than a split dose, even though they were given the two groups were given the same amount of iron per day. Just how you dosed it resulted in different outcomes of hemoglobin. Generally speaking, if you can take it early in the day, it's better because hepcidin's lower. However, you then need to consider whether or not you're having tea and coffee or milk at breakfast, because those are confounding factors. There's emerging data in non-athletes that taking your iron supplement every other day might be better for both gastrointestinal tolerance and also total bioavailability. If you have to correct an iron, that's probably not enough iron going in. But if you need to maintain iron stores, you have a great ferritin, then every other day is probably just as good as and can be just as effective as every day. Again, that data is not in athletes. So, and then there's a whole other host of questions there that we need to start to unpack, like better understanding energy availability and glycogen contents. Acute low energy availability causes a massive spike in hepcidin, by the way. There's a brand new paper in JAP out of Japan on that last year. So maybe hepcidin's an early indicator of poor energy availability. Big question mark on that question. So as you start to dig into these things, you start to learn more and more. And I think especially given how important optimizing hemoglobin is to endurance performance, and how important iron is and the interplay with altitude and iron and hemoglobin, that being up to speed on this field is a place to watch and important. If interested, I've been on a few of the reviews, but Pete Peeling, his group, has a couple of just absolutely outstanding two or three seminal reviews in the last few years on this topic that that you can look for. Right, that was a long answer. Sorry about that. That was a short question.
No problem. A long answer would have been 2 hours, I think, on a topic like that, as with all things when it comes to endurance sports and sports science in general. But just one follow-up on that. I would ask you, who should take an iron supplement in the first place? What are the prerequisites for taking one?
Yeah, so there's a few cutoffs there. And Pete's most recent, are you still there? Sorry.
Yep.
Okay. My screen just flashed. All good. We're good. There's a few prerequisites there, and Pete just published some of this. Normal clinical blood work data suggests that unless ferritin's below around 10 or 11, it's no problem. However, there's now enough data in athletes to suggest a cutoff of 30 to 35. And Pete's most recent publication and another one I was on around altitude nutrition, we've really nailed that. And so again, not to plug, or I will plug my own work, is last year I was a lead author on nutrition for altitude in sports medicine. And there's a huge section in there on iron optimization and a flow chart of what you need to do. So you can check that out. It's open access. It's free. Anyways, we also had a cutoff of 35 for ferritin, in that if an athlete is under 35, and dare I say probably 40 or 50 for the guys, that it's definitely, a yellow or orange flag. It's not a red flag yet, but you better get on top of it and you better start thinking about implementation of an oral iron supplement. As if it starts to erode more, you're going to start to have some drop-offs in training indicators. And that data is Della Valla out of Cornell, where they had large groups of rowers, like 40 or 50 of them, where they showed lowish irons, but not anemic irons, already impact training adaptation and some performance indicators. And so I think it's important as an endurance athlete, you probably get routine blood work anywhere from 1 to 5 times a year, depending on your context. For example, if you're a male athlete that's never been anemic, that has high iron intakes in your diet, maybe you need one blood work a year. If you're a male or female athlete that's been repeatedly anemic despite taking supplements, and maybe you're on a vegan diet, I would be checking that 5 or 6 times a year, because you're probably living on the edge. And so you just have to look at those types of things. And generally speaking, in most instances, if you're on top of it, you can definitely address optimizing iron in the blood and hemoglobin through an oral iron supplement. Only in extreme cases is IV iron ever used, very extreme. In fact, the better surveillance we've done with blood work, the less often we've ever had to use IV iron, because we're able to detect small drops early and address it through oral iron and through dietary iron, optimizing your diet for iron as well. So yeah, those are some contextual factors. I would say, 30 to 60% of endurance females are probably routinely on an iron supplement 6 to 10 months a year, and maybe 20 to 40% of males. I'm just totally spitballing on that. It's just an estimate off the top of my head, but it's probably that kind of level to make sure that...
That refers to the ones you're working with and have had tested. So meaning that potentially there are a lot of people that haven't really investigated this and had tests taken might need supplementation without knowing it.
Correct. And so those percentages are in the athlete cohorts I work with. You're right. So they're going to be much higher. And some people listening in are like, oh man, wow. Okay. Maybe I need to unpack this a little bit more and have a look here.
Yeah. And one more topic that I want to get into here is just going back a bit to the general nutrition considerations for ultra endurance activity specifically. So I guess you would count half Ironman and full Ironman definitely to that, but also things like ultra running and really long cycling races that are popping up everywhere now. So I think that in your initial advice, you covered a lot of the key points, but is there anything else that you would like to mention for ultra endurance athletes when it comes to their day-to-day nutrition?
Yeah, so... Day-to-day or competition nutrition as well?
Start with day-to-day and then we'll move on to nutrition.
Okay. Yeah, so...
The race nutrition, sorry.
Yeah, so the... I believe off the top of my head, the World Athletics, formerly IAAF, has defined an ultra race as 4 hours or maybe 5 hours or longer. So that's that's a fair comment, and I would put it into that ballpark. I don't think that the general day-to-day nutrition recommendations that we talked about at the start need to be radically different for an ultra runner, and need to be based again on that concept that I mentioned earlier that, James Morton and Graham Close and Sam Impey have coined, which is fuel for the work required. So it depends on how much you're training and how long those training sessions are, and how much calories you need to consume to be an optimal energy availability. But the recommendations I gave earlier for day to day, I don't think need to be any different, for the ultra crowd.
And what about in-race nutrition? And by the way, yeah, I think I looked it up and it's 4 hours is the cutoff that is defined as ultra endurance activities.
Yeah. So it's funny because then some people in the men's 50K aren't race walk, aren't doing an ultra, but some people are, because some guys get under 4 hours and some guys don't. So that's kind of,
yeah, and the half Ironman is often
exactly
an ultra endurance for men, but an ultra endurance event for women.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so for competition nutrition, it can change and be quite variable. So by that, what I mean is the longer the event, so the less the intensity of the event. I've just stated something really obvious. But the less the intensity of the event, the more your range of nutrition options increases. So if you're in a 3 or 4 day ultra race, 2 or 3 day ultra race, you can eat a lot of real food, you know, soups with noodles and salt and pretzels. I've seen pizza at the side of a 3 day ultra race course because the intensity is relatively so low that you can consume these foods that normally would cause significant GI upset in the races that are in, you know, 1 and 2 hours where the intensity is really high. I would also consider the implementation of more and more real foods as the race duration gets on, especially out past 15 to 20 hours. It's more satisfying for the athlete. They look forward to real food. You can only put so many gels down before you're sick of them. So that's one. Two, I think a couple of years ago with Ricardo Da Costa, who's an absolute world expert on gastrointestinal and FODMAPs and gluten-free and GI side effects, and then Dr. Martin Hoffman, who's a physician out of California, who is actually a sports med physician for a lot of these really big, big ultra races like Western States, and myself, we penned two review articles on nutrition and hydration aspects of ultra running and ultra racing. And in there, I had the honor and pleasure of, it was this complex, of trying to write what we know around substrate and fuel utilization in ultra sports. And a lot of it is indirect based on heart rate and tracers. And there's only actually a handful of data done in that space. And basically, through some back of the envelope calculations, I did put in there that somewhere out between 10 and 15 hours of high intensity elite racing, the exercise intensities are low enough, of which carbohydrate demand is then low enough, that perhaps a keto diet could be quite effective in those types of ultra endurance events. I'm not saying it's for everyone, but in those instances, I think there is the potential that if you have lots of GI side effects, carbohydrates don't agree with you that well, that in out of those types of durations of races, that the consideration of a keto diet intervention might be warranted to try out. I have never endorsed it for any Olympic sport because the intensity is just way too high and you absolutely need glycogen and carbohydrate for performance. But in that instance, that is one other major shift or change that I'll just highlight. And I should have said that earlier around the general diet, but I framed it up here around the race demands.
Yeah, no, that's perfectly fine. And that brings us to other ways to potentially mitigate GI distress. So we have recently seen quite a bit of data around things like FODMAP diets and so on. So can you talk about what that is, how that works, but also are there any other ways of mitigating GI distress in racing?
Yeah, I'm going to keep my answer here high level because that could be another 1 or 2 hour podcast. And if you haven't had her on, Dana Liz is a former PhD student of mine who did her PhD and focused in on gluten and FODMAP interventions. And Dana Liz now works part-time with the new Israeli Startup Nation pro cycling team and has tons of experience in this space. She'd be a great podcast for you. I'll plug her.
I'll email her.
Yeah, no, she's well-spoken, really experienced, works in NBA basketball. Anyways, basically the idea there is that there's a lot of crossover in symptomology between gluten and FODMAPs. And FODMAPs are offending fructose, oglio, and disaccharides, or maladapted, malabsorbed polyphenols. That's what FODMAP stands for. So it is things like lactose. It is things like onions. It is things like apples. Apples are very high in fructose. And you can look up FODMAP. And we have found in some pilot data that we published, Dana Liz is the first author. I'm in the author list or somewhere, that it does seem to improve some GI symptoms in some athletes. We did a double-blind crossover on gluten and found nothing. And if you look at the IBS, irritable bowel syndrome research, and there's a mountain of papers there, when you reduce FODMAPs or when you reduce gluten, you also reduce FODMAPs. So perhaps in some of those instances, with individuals self-selecting lower gluten, they're also resulting in lower FODMAPs. And it's actually the FODMAPs that's maybe driving some of the response rather than the gluten, unless you're celiac, of course, or you have a celiac sensitivity, which is only about 10% of the population. So we have played around with that, worked on with that a little bit. In extreme GI situations with athletes, we have tried a FODMAP intervention. I don't think anyone, any professional would ever recommend to go low or zero FODMAP for weeks and weeks and months on end. It's just too challenging in your diet. And I think you would probably cause eating disorders or disordered eating. But instead, it's periodizing the implementation of a low or lower FODMAP intervention in and around maybe key training sessions or key races to just make sure the GI side effects are then minimized around those key efforts. And especially around races, when the intensity is higher, you're anxious in a good way for the races. You got the butterflies in the stomach. And in many instances, it's all those conditions that push people over the edge with a GI problem. And so perhaps in some individuals, they could consider, you know, a 3 or 4 day low or lower FODMAP on the way into a race. Again, I don't think anyone would really recommend it for weeks and months on end. So hopefully that gives a very 2 minute top level overview on that. But GI side effects in endurance racing is worth almost an entire podcast, in my humble opinion.
Yeah, yeah. And one more subtopic on that I want to ask you, and whether you answer it from the researcher's perspective or the practitioner's is up to you, or both. But training the gut, what's your recommendations around that, training the gut to consume carbohydrate or whatever race nutrition you plan to consume in your event?
Yeah, I believe in it. So Oscar, you can droop and I first penned that idea of training the gut on a letter, an editorial question and answer back and forth 10 years ago, 15 years ago, around what interventions do we need to consider about for the first sub-2-hour marathon. And we wrote, don't forget the gut, you can train your gut. And there is no direct evidence in humans, but there is a fair amount of animal evidence in rodents and in pigs to show that your gut transporters can be upregulated, specifically your carbohydrate transporters can be upregulated in your gastrointestinal tract, both in terms of number, but also density and efficiency of transporters when the gut has been continually exposed to sugar, to carbohydrate, that it may have adverse outcomes for obesity, but it may have unique interventive opportunity in endurance sport where one might want to try and, train the gut. And so generally speaking, and I wrote a paper on this in terms of a case study, I think in 2012, we will implement more and more focus on gut adaptation in the 4 to 6 weeks before a major event. And especially in the last couple of weeks, with the idea that you've then not only practiced your fueling protocol, but hopefully at the gut level, upregulated those transporters as well. The only indirect evidence we have in humans that this may work is a study by Greg Cox and all with Louise Burke already back 20 years ago, I think 2000. Where they had two groups. One group trained with carbohydrate sports drinks all the way through training, and another group didn't. And after 1 month of training with a carbohydrate sports drink, the only outcome between those two groups that was different was that carbohydrate oxidation was about 15 or 20% higher in the group that had trained with the sports drinks all the way through training, which seems to suggest that their gut had been upregulated, that they were able to absorb more and therefore oxidize more carbohydrate from the sports drink using tracer methodology in that group. So there's no direct evidence. I'm unaware of nasogastric biopsies in athletes because that would be the direct evidence, but there is a fair amount of indirect evidence. And then in the field working with athletes, I've seen great progress in the ability to slowly increase and upregulate how much carbs and fluids athletes can successfully tolerate and turn into performance. You know, I've had athletes start with 30 grams an hour and having some GI side effects, and we've worked them slowly up to 50 or 60 grams an hour as runners. So we've been able to double it over a 6-week period.
Yeah, and I have an injury in the pipeline with Aitor Villibay Morales, who I'm sure you've seen his work in ultra mountain runners, where they had one group that consumed 120 grams of carbohydrate per hour in ultra trail running, and they were, of course, they didn't have direct evidence. It was field research, but they were well able to tolerate that after a 3-week period of training. So that was quite interesting.
Totally. And now that I think about it too, Ricardo da Costa has a paper with other indirect evidence using some of the gut permeability markers that you can measure on the breath, and also showing it looks like gut permeability is better after you've trained the gut with carbohydrate than before. So yeah, there's a fair amount of indicators to support that intervention, and it is absolutely an intervention that I strongly consider or encourage for anyone that's going to have to take in fluids and carbohydrate while they race.
Yeah, and I have a couple of interviews that I also have in the pipeline with nutritionists or coaches from World Tour cycling teams, where I've asked them, like, what do you think will be the big things to change or develop in the next 2 to 5 years? And they have both said that it's basically that riders will be taking on more carbohydrates during races. They will be training their guts to be able to do that and taking on more. And yeah, that's what they think will be coming in the not too distant future.
That makes really, really good sense. Cause on some of those really long stages of, you know, approaching 6 hours, plus hopefully you're getting 8 to 10 hours of sleep. And then there's a transfer, you know, a long bus ride to the next stage start. All of a sudden at the end of the day, you're only left with 4 to 6 hours to try to consume, in some athletes, 4,000 to 7,000 calories. It's just not going to happen. So you have to offset that with, okay, especially early in the stage when maybe the intensity is lower, just let's eat so that you, in those few hours that you have to load back up, you don't have to take in quite as much nutrition. And on the 1-day races, it doesn't matter near as much, but on a 3-week tour, to get and be strong in the last 5 to 6 days, it's an accumulation of how much of many things, but one of which is just how much nutrition you can take in the first few weeks.
Yeah. All right. So I think we're approaching the end here, and I just want to ask you the rapid fire questions, which are very short. Take one sentence to answer these. And the first question is, what's your favorite book, blog, or resource related to endurance sports?
I got a plug by Canadian Alex Hutchinson. Alex Hutchinson writes a great Outside Magazine blog and articles, and also has written the book called Endure. And I think he does an outstanding job at capturing science in a way that everyone can understand.
Yeah, I totally agree. He's a past guest on the podcast, and probably around 33% of the guests answer this question with either Endure or his blog. So he's by far the leader in that category.
Next question is, he's also he's also a friend and colleague. Is we're about the same age and crossed over racing for a few years, many years ago. So I'm biased there.
Did he also race David Epstein? I think he's Canadian as well.
David's a bit older than I am, so I didn't cross over with David, but I do know of his legendary high school prowess. He was a very, very good high school runner in Ontario, where I grew up.
Right. Next one. What's a personal habit that's helped you achieve success?
I would say staying disciplined and diligent on keeping my email and work folders on my computer organized. I know this sounds really mundane and boring, but and nowadays, with just so much stuff coming at us, that day in and day out, staying on top of that has saved me hours upon hours upon hours. And I can find files and I have a system set up. And that is something I think that is undervalued and underappreciated, but is really impactful and really helpful for those of us that have a lot of electronic emails and content coming at us.
That's a really cool answer. I like that. And finally, who's somebody that you look up to or that has inspired you?
I have so many people on that. I just did a talk and I have a slide I keep adding to, and the font keeps getting smaller and smaller because I have about 70 names up there. But if there's one of those names kind of other than my parents, of course, I'd have to say my PhD advisor, Lawrence Spreet at the University of Guelph. He's an absolute level legend in skeletal muscle metabolism and caffeine and performance and applied research and mechanistic research. But above and beyond that, he's been married for over 30 years. He still is fit and plays hockey. He's got three kids, and his ability to balance out the work-life demands is exemplary. And he was the MC at my wife and I's wedding, and continues to be a great mentor for me.
Perfect. And finally, where can the listeners follow you and follow your updates of work you're doing and so on?
I can barely maintain a Twitter account. So I'm not on Instagram. I think I'm on Facebook. I don't even know. So I'm going to have to say Twitter. I don't have time to blog or podcast or have websites. But I am decently active on Twitter. So T. Stellingworth. And I usually try to update our newest work or what's going on there. Every now and again, I'll have a bit of a rant that is interesting too.
Yeah, that is a good follow, definitely. All right, thank you so much, Trent. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you, and I've learned a lot. I hope that the listeners will too.
Thanks for having me on, and thanks for the great questions. All the best.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview with Trent. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com. And I want to remind you once again that on the podcast page on the website, you can find episodes according to their respective categories. So for example, you can just click the nutrition tab and find all the episodes of the podcast that have been categorized as nutrition related episodes. So that's a cool feature that I want to draw some attention to. There will be a ton of links in the show notes and in the episode description, both to related episodes that I've done with different researchers in the field of nutrition, and also to relevant research papers that we discussed. I won't name any, just check the episode description or the show notes. On Thursday, we have another Q&A coming out, as usual. And then next Monday, I interview coach Joakim Villén from Sweden, who is the coach of, among others, Vasco Villasa, who was the surprise silver medalist from the ITU World Championships in Hamburg in 2020 at the sprint distance. Vasco had a breakthrough race and surprised probably all of us with his performance, where only Vincent Louis was stronger on the day. If you are looking for training plans, coaching services, or are interested in going to Mallorca for a training camp in April 2021, check out scientifictriathlon.com and the respective pages, where we have all the information about all of that available. And for any further questions or inquiries, just email me, michael@scientifictriathlon.com, and it's Michael with a K. Big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Hydration, that you can find on precisionhydration.com. Go and get a free hydration plan by taking a quick online quiz that will give you a really good ballpark estimate for how much sodium you lose in your sweat, and get 15% off your order of electrolytes with the promo code DETTRIATHLONSHOW15. And thank you to Roka, that you can find on roka.com. Go and check out their wetsuits, dry suits, swimskins, goggles, high-performance eyewear, and prescription glasses and sunglasses, now with the option to add blue light blocking coating. And get 20% off your order with the promo code that you can get on roka.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Q. keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.